bring it on tape, we're going to have to mention Mary Simple's name.
Right. We thank Mary Simple for getting this article for us, that we mentioned last night. We thank Mary Simple for remembering after Moshe Day the way we feel during Moshe Day. Okay, it's probably not every day that we quote a Gaiish woman by Moshe Day, but I think it's worth it. Yeah, I don't know if I'll read the whole thing, but we'll listen. Zevi, when it starts getting boring. What? No, you already look worse. Three Days to See by Helen Keller. It seems that this was published in Atlantic Monthly, January 1933. All of us had read thrilling stories in which the hero had only a limited and specified time to live. Sometimes it was as long as a year, sometimes as short as 24 hours. But always we were interested in discovering just how the doomed man chose to spend his last days or his last hours. I speak, of course, of free men who have a choice, not condemned criminals whose sphere of activities is strictly limited. Such stories set us thinking, wondering what we should do under similar circumstances. What events, what experiences, what associations should we crowd into those last hours as mortal beings? What happiness should we find in reviewing the past? What regrets? Sometimes I have thought that it would be an excellent rule to live each day as if we should die tomorrow. Such an attitude would emphasize sharply the values of life. We should live each day with a gentleness, a vigor, and a keenness of appreciation which are often lost when time stretches before us in the constant panorama of more days and months and years to come. Most of us, however, take life for granted. We know that one day we must die, but usually we picture that day as far in the future. When we are healthy, death is all but unimaginable. We seldom think of it. The days stretch out in an endless vista, so we go about our petty tasks, hardly aware of our listless attitude toward life. The same lethargy, I am afraid, characterizes the use of all our facilities and senses. Only the deaf appreciate hearing. Only the blind realize the manifold blessings that lie in sight. Particularly does this observation apply to those of us who have lost sight and hearing in adult life. But those who have never suffered impairment of sight or hearing seldom make the fullest use of these blessed faculties. Their eyes and ears take in all sights and sounds hazily, without concentration and with little appreciation. It is the same old story of not being grateful for what we have until we lose it, not being conscious of health until we are ill. I have often thought it would be a blessing if each human being were stricken blind and deaf for a few days at some time during his early adult life. Darkness would make him more appreciative of sight. Silence would teach him the joys of sound. She was deaf too. Now and then I have tested my seeing friends to discover what they see. Mamish, interesting. Recently I was visited by a good friend who had just returned from a long walk in the woods. And I asked her what she had observed. Nothing in particular, she replied. Could be the friend just didn't want to make her feel bad. I might have been incredulous had I not been accustomed to such responses, for long ago I became convinced that the seeing see little. How is it possible, I asked myself, to walk for an hour through the woods and see nothing worthy of note? I, who cannot see, find hundreds of things to interest me through mere touch. I feel the delicate symmetry of a leaf. I pass my hands lovingly about the smooth skin of a silver birch, or the rough, shaggy bark of a pine. In spring, I touch the branches of trees, hopefully, in search of a bud, the first sign of awakening nature after her winter sleep. I feel the delightful, velvety texture of a flower and discover its remarkable convolutions, and sometimes of the miracle of nature, and something of the miracle of nature is revealed to me. Occasionally, if I am very fortunate, I place my hand gently on a small tree and feel the happy quiver of a bird in full song. I am delighted to have the cool waters of a brook rush through my open fingers. To me, a lush carpet of pine needles or spongy grass is more welcome than the most luxurious Persian rug. To me, the pageant of seasons is a thrilling and unending drama, the action of which streams through my fingertips. At times, my heart cries out with longing to see all these things. If I can get so much pleasure from mere touch, how much more beauty must be revealed by sight. Yet those who have eyes apparently see little. The panorama of color and action which fills the world is taken for granted. It is human, perhaps, to appreciate little that which we have and to long for that which we have not. But it is a great pity that in the world of light, the gift of sight is used only as a mere convenience rather than as a means of adding fullness to life. If I were the president of the university, I should establish a compulsory course in how to use your eyes. The professor would try to show his pupils how they could add joy to their lives by really seeing what passes unnoticed before them. He would try to awaken their dormant and sluggish faculties. Perhaps I can best illustrate by imagining what I should most like to see if I were given the use of my eyes, say, for just 3 days. And while I am imagining, suppose you too set your mind to work on the problem of how to work on, set your mind to work on the problem of how you would use your own eyes if you had only 3 days to see. If the oncoming darkness of the third night, you knew that the sun would never rise for you again, how would you spend those 3 intervening days? What would you most want to let your gaze rest upon? I naturally should want most to see things that have become dear to me through the years of darkness. You too would want to let your eyes rest long on the things that have become dear to you, so that you could take the memory of them with you into the night that loomed before you. If by some miracle I were granted 3 seeing days to be followed by a relapse into darkness, I should divide the period into 3 parts. On the first day, I should want to see the people whose kindness and gentleness and companionship have made my life worth living. First, I would like to gaze long upon the face of my dear teacher, Miss Anne Sullivan Macy, who came to me when I was a child and opened the outer world to me. I should want not merely to see the outline of her face so that I could cherish it in my memory, but to study that face and to find in it the living evidence of the sympathetic tenderness and patience with which she accomplished the difficult task of my education. I should like to see in her eyes that strength of character that has enabled her to stand firm in the face of difficulties, and that compassion for all humanity which she has revealed to me so often. I do not know what it is to see into the heart of a friend through that window of the soul, the eye. I can only see through my fingertips the outline of a face. I can detect laughter, sorrow, and many other obvious emotions. I know my friends from the feel of their faces, but I cannot really picture their personalities, of course, through the thoughts they... I'm not sure exactly what she's saying. But I am denied that deeper understanding of them, which I am sure would come through sight of them, through watching their reaction to various expressed and circumstances, through noting the immediate and fleeting reactions of their eyes and countenance. Friends who are near to me I know well, because through the months and years they reveal themselves to me in all their phases. But of casual friends, I have only an incomplete impression, an impression gained from hand clasp, from spoken words which I have taken from their lips with my fingertips. She used to put her lips, her fingers on people's mouths, and when they spoke, she was able to understand what they were saying, or which they tap into the palm of my hand. How much easier, how much more satisfying it is for you who can grasp quickly the essential qualities of another person by watching the subtleties of expression, the quiver of a muscle, the flutter of a hand. Does it ever occur to you to use your sight to see the inner nature of a friend or acquaintance? Do not most of you seeing people grasp casually the outward features of a face and let it go at that? For instance, can you describe accurately the faces of 5 good friends? Some of you can, but many cannot. As an experiment, I have questioned husbands of long standing about the color of their wife's eyes, and often they expressed embarrassed confusion and admit that they do not know. And incidentally, it is a chronic complaint of wives that their husbands do not notice new dresses, new hats, and changes in household arrangements. A little Shalom Bias advice while we're at it. The eyes of seeing persons soon become accustomed to the routine of their surroundings and may actually see only the startling and spectacular. But even in viewing the most spectacular sights, their eyes are lazy. Court records reveal every day how inaccurately eyewitnesses, in quotes, see. A given event will be seen in several different ways by as many witnesses. Some see more than others, but few see everything that is within the range of their vision. Oh, the things I should see if I had the power of sight for just 3 days. The first day would be a busy one. I should call to me all my dear friends and look long into their faces, imprinting upon my mind the outward evidence of the beauty that is within them. I should let my eyes rest too on the face of a baby, so that I could catch a vision of the eager, innocent beauty which proceeds the individual's consciousness of the conflict which life develops, godless. And I should like to look into the loyal, trusting eyes of my dogs, and she names all her dogs. On that busy first day, I should also view the small, simple things of my home. I want to see the warm colors in the rug under my feet, the pictures on the walls, the intimate trifles that transform a house into a home. My eyes would rest respectfully on the books in raised type which I have read, but they would be more eagerly interested in the printed books, which seeing people can read, but during the long night of my life, the books I have read and those which have been read to me have built themselves into a great shining lighthouse, revealing to me the deepest channels of human life and the human spirit. You'll see through the article how much she understands about sight. It's marvel. How much she read and must have understood. Someone not seeing to describe sight, it's unbelievable. In the afternoon of that first seeing day, I should take a long walk in the woods and intoxicate my eyes on the beauties of the world of nature, trying desperately to absorb in a few hours the vast splendor which is constantly unfolding itself to those who can see. On the way home from my woodland jaunt, my path would lie near a farm, so that I may see the patient horses plowing in the field, and the serene content of men living close to the soil, and I should pray for the glory of a colorful sunset. When dusk had fallen, I should experience the double delight of being able to see by artificial light, which the genius of man has created to extend the power of his sight when nature decrees darkness. In the night of that first day of sight, I should not be able to sleep. So full would my mind be of the miracles of the day. The next day, the second day of sight, I should arise with the dawn and see the thrilling miracle by which night is transformed into day. I should behold with awe the magnificent panorama of light with which the sun awakens the sleeping earth. And then she goes through this. The second day, she would spend time on looking at art and museums, and she would list each museum and what she would look at. So on. The following, it's just to be the least interesting to us, and I don't want to read the whole thing. The following morning, I should again greet the dawn, anxious to discover new delights, for I am sure that for those who have eyes which really see, the dawn of each day must be perpetually new revelation of beauty. This, according to the terms of my imagined miracle, is to be my third and last day of sight. I shall have no time to waste in regrets or longings. There is too much to see. The first day I devoted to my friends, animate and inanimate. The second day revealed to me the history of man and nature. Today I shall spend in the workday world of the present, amid the haunts of men going about the business of life. Where can one find so many activities and conditions of men as in New York? So the city becomes my destination. I start from my home in the quiet little suburb of Forest Hills, Long Island. Here, surrounded by green lawns, trees, and flowers, are neat little houses, happy with the voices and movement of wives and children, havens of peaceful rest for men who toil in the city. I drive across the lacy structure of steel which spans the East River, and I get a new startling vision of the power and ingenuity of the mind of man. Busy boats chug and scurry about the river, racy speed boats, and so on, describing all the boats. If I had long days of sight ahead, I should spend many of them watching the delightful activity upon the water. I look ahead. Before me rise the fantastic towers of New York, a city that seems to have stepped from the pages of a fairy story. What an awe-inspiring sight, these glittering spires, these vast banks of stone and steel, sculptures such as the gods might build for themselves. This animated picture is a part of the lives of millions of people every day. How many, I wonder, give it so much as a second glance? Very few, I fear. Their eyes are blind to this magnificent sight because it is so familiar to them. I hurry to the top of one of those gigantic structures, the Empire State Building, for there, a short time ago, I saw the city below through the eyes of my secretary. I am anxious to compare my fancy with reality. I am sure I should not be disappointed in the panorama spread out before me, for to me it would be a vision of another world. Now I begin my rounds of the city. First I stand at a busy corner, merely looking at people, trying by the sight of them to understand something of their lives. I see smiles and I am happy. I see serious determination and I am proud. I see suffering and I am compassionate. I stroll down Fifth Avenue. I throw my eyes out of focus so that I see no particular object but a seething kaleidoscope of color. I am certain that the colors of women's dresses moving in a throng must be a gorgeous spectacle of which I should never tire. But perhaps if I had sight, I should be like most other women, too interested in styles and the cut of individual dresses to give much attention to the splendor of color in the mass. I am convinced, too, that I should become a window shopper, for it must be a delight to the eye to view the myriad articles of beauty on display. From Fifth Avenue, I make a tour of the city to Park Avenue, to the slums, to factories, to parks where children play. I take a stay-at-home trip abroad by visiting the foreign quarters. Always my eyes are open wide to all the sights of both happiness and misery, so that I may probe deep and add to my understanding of how people work and live. My heart is full of the images of people and things. My eyes pass lightly over no single trifle. It strives to touch and hold closely each thing its gaze rests upon. Some sights are pleasant, filling the heart with happiness, but others are miserably pathetic. To these latter I do not shut my eyes, for they too are part of life. To close the eye on them is to close the heart and mind. My third day of sight is drawing to an end. Perhaps there are many serious pursuits to which I should devote the few remaining hours, but I am afraid that on the evening of that last day, I should run away to the theater, to a hilarious, funny play, so I may appreciate the overtones of comedy in the human spirit. At midnight, my temporary respite from blindness would cease, and permanent night would close in on me again. Naturally, in these three short days, I should not have seen all I wanted to see. But only when darkness has again descended upon me should I realize how much I had left unseen. It's just amazing how she can project this. But my mind would be so overcrowded with glorious memories that I should have little time for regrets. Thereafter, the touch of every object would bring a glowing memory of how that object looked. Perhaps this short outline of how I should spend 3 days of sight does not agree with the program you should set for yourself if you knew that you were about to be stricken blind. I am, however, sure that if you actually faced that fate, your eyes would open to things you had never seen before, storing up memories for the long night ahead. You would use your eyes as never before. Everything you saw would become dear to you. Your eyes would touch and embrace every object that came within the range of your vision. Then at last you would really see, and a new world of beauty would open itself before you. I, who am blind, can give one hint to those who see, one admonition to those who would make full use of the gift of sight. Use your eyes as if tomorrow you would be stricken blind, and the same method can be applied to other senses. Hear the music of voices, the song of a bird, the mighty strains of an orchestra, as if you were to be stricken deaf tomorrow. Touch every object you want to touch, as if tomorrow your tactile sense would fail. Smell the perfume of flowers, taste with relish each morsel, as if tomorrow you could never smell and taste again. Make the most of every sense. Glory in all the facets of pleasure and beauty which the world reveals to you through the several means of contact which nature provides. But of all the senses, I am sure that sight must be the most delightful. That's the article. Incredible article. Did it get boring? Incredible article. So what do you think? See differently, no? For a few minutes, we're going to see differently. It's an amazing thing. It's amazing avoda, but it's an amazing thing that we live in such a generation of such depression and sadness, and imagine how much joy we could just have from being able to see. Like, we have so much to start with. We all have five senses. It's just so much to start. We already start with so much to be happy about. And, you know, there are people, we know of people, Gedolim and Balei Musar, that they had nothing, and they would be just, like, so happy to be alive, and we consider it some kind of frumkeit. Maybe it's not a frumkeit, maybe it's reality. Maybe their wealth of what they're able to appreciate in the world that they live in is just much richer than the wealth of what we're able to appreciate from the same thing. Something to really think about. I think it's a good Purim, Dika Shmuz. Purim is about Nimavas L'chaim, it's about appreciating being alive. It's part of what it's about. Appreciating life. Appreciating being alive. with nothing else, just life. You know, they're in the middle of killing a woman in Florida. You know about that, Mordechai? What? You know about that? You know about that? Zevi, you know about that?
Yeah,
Ellie? Very simple. Shalom, you know about that? What? You don't know? You don't know that the government of the United States of America is in the middle of committing murder as we speak? You're not aware of that? What? There's a woman in Florida. Am I right? There's a woman in Florida who's brain damaged. And she's not on a respirator. She's not on a hemodialysis machine, you know, which cleans your blood and things like that. She's not on anything. She just has a feeding tube, which I know, I once had a sister at a feeding tube. It's just a way to put food into the person's body who can't swallow. That's all it is. It's not a life support. And her husband, well, to get to the real bottom of the story, her husband found someone else he'd like to be married to. So her husband has been working the court system, trying to get a heter to pull her feeding tube so that she should starve to death. And her parents are begging that they should leave her alive. And her husband says that she doesn't. She's brain damaged. She can't do anything. She can't do anything. She's lying. She's in bed. She's brain damaged. Her doctors are not 100% sure that she's not aware of what's going on around her. Even if she's brain damaged, but the brain, a dog also knows a little bit what's going on. They're not 100% sure, and who could be 100% sure what's going on in someone's seichel? And they pass Kentucky to remove her feeding tube. And the president and many members of Congress and the Senate are very, very upset, and they're trying to reverse the Roya HaGezeira. But right now, she's in the middle of starving to death. And I heard someone on the radio today describing the process. It's mamish horrific. That the partial dehydration, they said that her skin is probably becoming dried out and cracked now. Her lips are probably, her nose is probably bleeding because the mucous membranes are trying to dry out. Eventually she'll be coughing and vomiting from pressure. She's starving to death. She's going to starve to death. It seems that would be better. A bunch of murderers were humiliated in a prison in Iraq a couple of months ago. That was not acceptable. But a woman who's not but brain damaged is being starved to death. That is acceptable. It's amazing. Do I have it right? What if it?
Why can't
this
guy
just
force her?
It's incredible. The thing is, mamish incredible. But the way we look at it, we're saying we have to realize that to us, life with a feeding tube, with brain damage and everything, life is such a valuable thing. This is reticha. It's absolute reticha. It's murder. This is Rabbi Anderson would point that out to you. This is Esav at his best. He's a Reitzeach. It's murder. Pure murder. The government is committing murder. Would they starve a murderer to death? They wouldn't starve a murderer to death. But this woman is brain damaged, so she could be starved. I heard someone say, rightfully so, that the reason why they're able to get away with that in today's society is because we live in an abortion society. We already came to terms with the fact that any life we don't understand, we could end. So with brain damage, this, that, it's all the same. What's the difference? That's correct. It creates a certain callousness to any life that we don't have a tefisa of. They have this idea to send to people who want to have abortions, send them pictures of what the baby looks like inside, which now they have perfect color pictures. And now think again if you want to kill it. You know, you just want to, it's like, I don't see it, you know, out of sight, you know. But Allah has kama v'kama, you know, toiva mechupelas aleinu, that we're alive, that we can see, that we can smell, that we can have aggravation, that we can have frustration, that we can live life, that we can have nisyonis, that we can, it's just, there's so much to just be alive. Just the mundane difficulties of life, the difficulties of life are a pleasure, when you think about it that way. To appreciate life, being alive. Anything once so I mentioned it before, that there's no such a thing as saying Lama Lichaim, I'm in so much pain, it's not worth being alive. Life is always a matana, no matter what. Allah has kama v'kama when it's such a fat matana like we have. An incredible thing. To have a woman who's blind write about with such clarity what she would want to see. It was hard for me not to get choked up while I was reading it. Rabbi Say, let's see.